BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Tillis Powell, Dennis Norden, Anne Scott James, and Frank Miller. Round one tries to test their vocabularies. Two marks if they get the meaning of these words right. We begin with Tillis Powell. Tillis, what is a unaw? U-N-A-U. Unaw.
It's an electrical term.
No, no.
It isn't.
Much more animal than that.
Much more animal.
Unicorn.
Oh.
Unicorn with
no.
Two corns.
Yes. Wrong end, Frank, but it's getting very near.
Oh.
It's a... No, it's a two-tailed unicorn.
Well, half a mark for getting that, a bit of that, and a very brilliant idea. I'd like to see a two-tailed unicorn. It's a Brazilian two-toed sloth. All right, Dennis Norden. What is a fizz? P-H-I-Z. Fizz.
Oh, well, I can tell you that one. A fizz is a fizzog.
Yes.
Or countenance, or physiognomy,
yes.
Or mush. Well, it's also a cartoonist. It's also an artist who illustrated some of Dickens's.
That's absolutely right. I wish I'd give you a bonus mark, but you get your two. Face, or the expression on a face, and it is an abbreviation of physiognomy. Anne Scott James, what is heptarchy, or aheptarchy?
Well, it means the rule of seven people.
That's all right. That'll do. Two marks. It can be, and sometimes is, government by seven rulers. That is a loose association of little kingdoms. But it was applied at the time when the Angles and the Saxons were in Britain, and they split up the whole of England into seven kingdoms. Frank Muir, what is or are vives? V-I-V-E-S.
Is it like rabies? Is it some kind of disease?
Yes, definitely. But you want four legs rather than two.
Oh, well, it's a disease affecting cattle. Or two birds. Rabies. It's foot and mouth. Foot and mouth, we think.
It's one of the few animals which is not affected by foot and mouth.
Mice.
Horse.
No, no.
Horses.
Yes. Horses. It's horses. A horse disease.
All right. One and a half out of two. You crept here with a fair amount of help. Vives are the swelling of a horse's submaxillary gland. Can also affect the ears of poor young horses who are out at grass for the first time. One and a half. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I hope the two women members of the teams will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, "Please don't talk about me when I've gone." And Anne Scott James and Dennis, yours is, "Discretion is the better part of valour." And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Frank and Dennis give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Round two is a round of odds and ends, and it's all about mothers and fathers. Two marks for correct answers. Dennis Powell, who is the mother of invention, and who said so?
Necessity.
Yes.
Was the mother of invention. Proverbs said so.
Yes.
Proverbs said so.
It's in Ray.
It's in proverbs of various kinds. It goes back to a Greek author as well.
Yes.
Oh, well.
Comedy writer.
Comedy writer. Plautus, Aristophanes. The only two I can think of.
All right, two marks. Aristophanes it does go back to, though an old proverb goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. Comes in Swift. Gulliver says, "I sold my shoes with wood that I cut from a tree. No man could more verify the truth that necessity is the mother of invention." Dennis Norden, who is the mother of harlots?
You mustn't giggle when they're literary programme. You simply be very sophisticated about it.
Sir,
yes?
What does harlots mean?
Well,
last matron.
I thought she was young.
It's a
play.
You could say necessity is the mother of no. You know, it's Babylon.
That's absolutely right. I think we pass over that one pretty quickly and go on to Anne Scott James. Who, according to whom, was the father of English criticism?
Oh, now.
It's generally Dryden.
Yes.
But according to who laid that down, I don't know.
Was it a contemporary?
No, a chap in the next century. Well, I think they overlap by a year or two, but a chap who wrote about poets in the 18th century. Very easy.
Very easy.
There's only about one.
Dr. Johnson.
Yes. One and a half again. Sam Johnson called Dryden the father of English criticism. Frank Muir. Who was known as the father of his country?
A fairly prolific.
Well, that's true, too.
Ataturk. It was George Washington.
Yes, absolutely right. That'll do. 2 marks it is. George Washington is commonly known as the father of his country, and it was, in fact, a journalist called Francis Bailey in 1779 who first called him that, and the expression stuck. Next round is the who, what, and where department. 2 marks again for correct answers. Dennis Powell, who was the Witch of Endor, E-N-D-O-R, Witch of Endor?
She was in the Old Testament.
Yes.
And somebody was advised to go and consult her.
Yes.
Samuel?
Samuel comes into the story.
It's in the Book of Samuel.
Yes, it's in the first Book of Samuel.
In the Book of Samuel.
Yes. She was the woman in 1 Samuel, chapter 28, with a familiar spirit whom Saul consulted when he was in terrible trouble, being frightened by the Philistines and forsaken by God. And at the request of Saul, the witch called up Samuel, who just recently died, and asked for his advice about these horrible Philistines. And Samuel prophesied not only the destruction of his army, but the death of Saul himself. So it really was pretty tough advice. Dennis Norden, what do you know about the Jenkins's Ear War? Or the War of Jenkins's Ear?
I know very little, and what that little is confused. It's something to do with the Spaniards.
Yes.
Who cut off the ear of somebody called Jenkins.
Yes.
And they sent it to England in a box, and the king opened it, and he said, "What's this?" I don't believe that's absolutely historically accurate.
Not
that's the gist.
That's a very good gist indeed.
Many a true word spoken in English.
One and a half, well deserved. Robert Jenkins was a master mariner, and he, in fact, went along himself to the House of Commons and showed a committee there his ear and said it had been cut off by a Spanish captain. And the English were so infuriated by that that they started a war against Spain in 1739, which was known as the War of Jenkins' Ear. In fact, it wasn't this wretched Spanish captain, but a pirate who cut off the ear, and the pirate had already been punished by the Spanish governor in Havana, Cuba, where it all happened. But Dennis got a lot of that right, one and a half.
Bit of it.
Anne Scott James, where would you find the following, and what were they? King Noble, Chanticleer, Bruin, Tybert, and Grimbert. If you would like to translate them into French, that might help you.
I was just going to say it sounds French. You've taken the words out of my
mouth. It sounds like a French pop group.
Is it in Gargantua?
No, it's earlier than that.
Earlier than that. Earlier than that?
Yes.
I'm sorry, that's going well.
Concentrate on Chanticleer. You may help.
Chanticleer is what they always call the rooster.
Yes. Think of Chanticleer's main enemy. I don't mean man.
Renard, I should say.
That's right. Now you're getting there.
Oh, is it in the...
Yes.
Oh, La Fontaine. Is
earlier.
It? No, that's... It must be, because it's much
earlier.
Later than...
Yes, but you're on the right tack.
We can't
we
be an Aesop, because that's
much...
That's quite wrong. The names are wrong. What's the earliest French thing you ever heard of?
Maurice Chevalier.
I've only heard of the Chanson de Roland and Gargantua and Pantagruel, and that's absolutely all I've ever heard of that far back.
And Villon.
We think it's in some French fables.
All right, one out of two. It's the old fable or bestiary, Reynard the Fox. And that was first written in France very early, about 1200. And then was brought over here, translated and printed by Caxton. It was one of his earliest printed books in 1481. And King Noble is the lion, and Chanticleer is the rooster, Bruin is the bear, Tybert the cat, and Grimbert is the badger. Now, Frank Muir, what precisely was the Spanish Main?
It was where the Spanish galleons used to ply along, carrying the Inca loot and the silver.
That's perfectly accurate.
The doubloon mines.
That's right. But
Moidor Mill.
This is a derivation from what it was originally. I mean, it's perfectly accurate. At one point,
it's a part of the coast. It's the Caribbean coast of South America.
Well done. Well done. Two marks you get. Well done. It's the mainland of America, next to the Caribbean, especially the bit from Panama to the mouths of the Orinoco. And afterwards it became used of the route across the sea where these Spanish register ships were carrying, as Frank says, trading and loot and the rest of it. Two marks. Now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For two marks, Tillis Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Please don't talk about me when I've gone.
It must be a song.
Yes, it is a song.
Please don't talk about me when I've gone.
Edwardian?
No,
Victorian?
No? Pop, you know.
Pop?
I think one out of two. Please don't talk about me when I've gone. I think the next line is, please don't talk about me from now on. And it's a modern song, or modernish, by Sidney Clare and Sammy Stett. And Sammy Stett was L. Jolson's accompanist. Sorry, I can never get that right. Well, now, Anne Scott James, the origin of your quotation, please. Discretion is the better part of valor.
Well, I think it's a proverb.
Yes. I think that's quite good enough. Two marks. It comes in a 16th century book of proverbs. It was afterwards used, almost certainly afterwards, by Beaumont and Fletcher, the dramatists. And you'll find it in Henry IV, Part 1 of Shakespeare. The better part of valor is discretion, I think, spoken by Falstaff. Two marks. Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so, back to Frank Muir and his quotation. Please don't talk about me when I've gone.
Well, regular listeners to this programme, if any, may have noticed that when invention flagged this side of the table, I usually tell a story more or less true about the poodles in my family. Over the years since this programme started, we've had four girl poodles, one bred from the other, and we've now only got two, and they've never been mine. They've always been my wife's and the children's. They've bagged one each, and I've never had one. And 2 months ago I've got my own dog at last, bitch actually, and it's an Afghan hound. Now the extraordinary thing about an Afghan hound is that there's very little literature about them, and I'm a great reader up of things before keeping them or using them. So there's a sort of funny American one. There's a book published about 1936. So what you're about to hear now is probably the only definitive guide to the care and maintenance of Afghan hounds. Now, an Afghan hound, first of all, is an achingly beautiful animal. Its size, when sort of 6 months old, which mine is about the size of a miniature donkey. It looks rather like a giant greyhound in a fun fur. When we first got her, she was upside down in my son's arms, drooling heavily from the car. A complacent dog, to start with. She doubled her weight to 2.5 stone in 2 months. Now, I'm not a morning man. I don't speak, you know, before I finish coughing about 11, and then I'm prepared to enter into a conversation. And normal dogs at breakfast, they just sit there whinnying slightly and looking at you, hopefully, that you'll give them a bit. But I was offered physical violence by this thing. Afghans wrestle. They don't just sit there hoping for a bit. Afghans are large dogs. They're curious looking. They have lots of fur under their tummies. and huge feet. They're either wearing boxing gloves, golden boxing gloves, or they're wearing golden pajama bottoms which are falling down. And suddenly this huge foot came beside me, this huge golden foot, and a black nose poked at my egg. And I suddenly realized there's a lot of height in an Afghan. So I pushed it aside, and it came back. This damn great paw came around my shoulder. My wife says I was exaggerating, but that dog put an arm lock on me as I was sitting over my breakfast egg. So, with an Afghan, what you have to do is you suddenly have to live rather higher off the ground. They are huge dogs. They eat. Afghans eat bones, biscuits, buttons. They eat bedding. They eat beds. They eat anything bendable. They eat boots. They eat book jackets. They eat books. They eat bookcases. They love gnawing on furniture legs. But if you're worried about them, the great thing to worry about is that Afghans are rather like, they're hollow inside, you see. They have this rib cage and sort of no innards. And they have a cubic capacity of liquid, rather resembling one of those old-fashioned fire extinguishers which are hanging on the wall. And just the same as a fire extinguisher, if you tap an Afghan on the nose or roll it over on its back, 2.5 gallons of liquid emerges. They can't help this. We've had it 2 months, and my wife is in despair. She thinks we've got the one dog in the world that'll never be house-trained. I mean, last night, she'd been outside and dug up the lawn, and she'd sat on the compost heap because it's warm on her bot. And she'd rolled in the mask, in the clippings, and she came in and she sat by me on the chair, and she laid her long black snout on my knee. And I looked at her, and her gold-flecked eyes looked at me, you know, and a beautiful warm feeling came over me. Or to be more exact, over my left leg. And I realized that Kassa was at it again. So that's how to keep an Afghan hound. But just a little word of warning. If you're around Staines, Egham, Thorpe, where I live, don't talk about the dog, because the dogs are terribly sensitive about being laughed at. It's all right with the poodles, if you say, you've got a funny poodle, because there are two of them, so they don't know which one you're talking to. So. But please, please don't talk about me one Afghan.
One consolation for Frank's wife, Polly, must be that it wasn't a Great Dane. Well, now we go back to Dennis Norton, and if you remember, his quotation was, "Discretion is the better part of valor."
If you can possibly rent your mind temporarily from Afghan hounds to the darker days of the last World War, World War II, because that was the last time that I heard a line which sounded reasonably like that quotation you've just heard. What I was that time was a rather strange job. I was a lab technician in a small unit which existed to train budding intelligence officers in how to interpret aerial reconnaissance photographs. Trouble was, I didn't have any aerial reconnaissance photographs because we were stationed in a remote part of Scotland and we didn't even have a plane. So what I used to do is I used to rely on old copies of the National Geographic magazine. I used to take any aerial photographs I found in that and give those to these budding intelligence officers. It was helpful as training, but not in a strict, immediate military sense helpful, because the National Geographic magazine tended to have photographs only of places like Peru and Van Diemen's Land. And we weren't really at war with them at the time, so... It was rather academic, but they learnt a lot of geography on the way. Now, the incident that I have in mind occurred at possibly the most exciting and stimulating period of my whole wartime career. Because what happened was, the unit camera club managed to get hold of a live female model. And she was persuaded to pose for the camera club in the nude. Now, she was a rather dim naffy girl called Ella Mahoney, and she wouldn't quite pose in the nude. She insisted on keeping on a grey flannel vest and PT shorts. But I can tell you that when you've been stationed in a remote part of northern Scotland for 8 months, that is still pretty heady stuff. So, on the evening when she did her modelling, not only was the whole camera club present clicking away with cameras, but also the adjutant, the officer's mess, a neighbouring company of Pioneer Corps, and two German parachutists. Well, it all meant a lot of work for me because I was the lab technician. I was the only bloke who could develop all the ensuing photographs, you see. And the CO had also laid on for the following day one of these aerial reconnaissance photograph interpretation tests. So it was all rather confusing for me because I had to dash backwards and forwards between all these photographs of Ella Mahoney and the photograph which I'd picked out of the National Geographic magazine, which was of a range of Tibetan mountains. And I got the enlarger and enlarged down to one mountain and sent a 10x8 round. Now, as I say, there was a lot of activity that night. Well, it's all very well for you to laugh because you're wise after the event, you see. You can see what I didn't, you see. And it, suddenly the realization came to me that maybe that wasn't a mountain that I'd actually enlarged for the intelligent officers to try and interpret. So I went round to the hut where they were looking at this 10x8, and I arrived there in time to hear one intelligence officer say, "Well, it looks to me about 5,000 feet high. I think there are cart tracks round the lower slopes." And another intelligence officer says, "I think I can see traces of recent troop movement." Decided, I caught the eye of the commanding officer and I said, "Sir, may I talk to you for a moment?" And he said, "What is it?" And I made a clean breast of the whole thing. And he said, "I see." And he turned round to the intelligence officers and he said, "I'm afraid, gentlemen, this test will have to be postponed for the moment as there is some confusion." And picking up one of these 10x8 photographs, he made what I thought was rather an apt twist at the time on an old quotation, because he said, pointing to the 10x8, he said, "This creation is Tibet, or part of Ella."
By your vote, ladies and gentlemen, the contest of the two stories is nevertheless won by Frank Muir, and the entire contest goes to the other team by one mark, Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. ¶¶
Thank you.